My name is Laura Logan, and I am at Shabazz Center in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I am doing a Zoom interview with Vicky Marks, who is in Atlanta, Georgia. Today is November 5, 2022, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hi, Vicky. Thank you so
Hi,
much for
Laura.
me today. Hello.
I'm good.
First, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your childhood. Can you please state when and where you were born?
I was born in 1951 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Can you tell me the names of your parents?
Julia Morris Marks and K.C., and that's K period C period Marks.
What was it like growing up in Atlanta, Georgia?
Well, as I mentioned, I was born in 1951, so it was in the midst of the segregation period in the South. But it was a great place to grow up because, one, we were very, and to a certain extent, insulated from a lot of stuff. And because it was segregated, you had African Americans in every profession. So you had doctors, you had lawyers, you had educators, any profession you could name, there was probably someone in the Black community that was doing that. So I grew up with the sense of knowing, and the confidence that I could do whatever I wanted to do. There were no limitations put on me because within the Black community, people had these professions. So I knew it was possible. The other thing that had a great impact, I think, on most Black Atlantans was that the fact that we had a very educated population because we had. We called it the AU Center, but there was Spelman, Morehouse, Clark, Atlanta University, and Morris Brown. So you had that center of educational excellence right here in your midst. So there was never any question in my mind. It wasn't even, will I go to college? I grew up just knowing I was going to go to college. So that was never, a question in my mind or my parents' minds.
Did your parents go to college?
My mother was an educator. She was a teacher, and she went to Morris Brown College, which at that time for the teaching profession, a lot of the teachers in the Atlanta public school system went to Morris Brown. So that was sort of their specialty at that time. My father got a scholarship to go to Morehouse, but he chose both my grandfathers were entrepreneurs. So that was my father's bent. So when he graduated from high school, Washington High School, which was the only Black high school in Atlanta, he and his best friend decided to start a restaurant. So they went into the restaurant business, and that was my father's first entrepreneurial venture. So I was a product of what I consider an outstanding public school education because we had Black teachers. We were in a segregated, school system. There were Black schools and there were white schools. And the teachers really cared about us and they instilled a sense of pride and confidence in us. I remember we would say the Pledge of Allegiance starting in elementary school, and then we would sing the Black National Anthem. So I knew that from the time I was like 5 years old. And I knew what that was about, and yada, yada, yada. And no one had to preach to us. I mean, it was everything about the beauty and wonder and the excellence of Black people I was surrounded by. So I always had a great deal of confidence in my abilities.
My mom is also a teacher, and my dad
Yes.
actually is a teacher. And I remember being in school feeling a little bit of pressure to be like the perfect student because, the teachers knew my mother. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, one of the things that my mother did, she never let us attend the schools that she was teaching, where she was teaching, because she did not want us to get any preferential treatment. Like you, because Atlanta was a small ecosystem of Black excellence, all the teachers sort of, in the educational school system, they knew each other. The only thing I felt was I knew if I did anything, they were going to call my mother and she was not going to be happy. But I didn't necessarily feel any pressure from it. I just knew that, that was going to happen. But that was pretty much the environment that I grew up in. In my neighborhood, everybody knew everybody. And if you did something wrong and someone saw you, they were going to call your mother. That was throughout my life, whether it was at school or at home, you knew somebody was always watching.
Mentioned an us just now. Did you had siblings?
Yes, there are four of us, three girls, one boy. My brother's the youngest. I'm the middle girl child. So I exhibit middle child syndrome.
How does that like manifest exactly?
Well, my sister was a, sort of the older child, very motherly, very maternal, very, very sweet. And I was sort of like the more rebellious, I'm gonna do what I want to do. I'm gonna walk my own path. You can't tell me anything type of thing.
You remember getting into trouble for anything?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I just, sort of did my thing, and if I got into trouble, I got into trouble. But
Right.
I wasn't thinking of it that way, and I didn't think that I was necessarily doing anything wrong or even being rebellious. But it was just I walked my own path, and sometimes that path got me into trouble.
Were there like, but were you a good student academically?
Yes, very good student.
What were your favorite subjects?
I liked everything. I absolutely loved school. I had some things that happened to me health-wise when I was in elementary school, so I missed some days. But then in high school, I would go to school sick. And there was one time I was really ill, and my mother wouldn't let me go to school, and I just broke down crying. I was just like undone that she wouldn't let me go to school. I absolutely love school. I love learning. So I've always, and I have a strong, I'm a very curious person. So if I heard of something, I would always, want to find out more about it. So that has, helped me a lot.
It stuck with
I think,
you.
yeah, I'm very analytical. I think that was one of the reasons I majored in economics. Not that I'm necessarily, a great math student, but I would do what I had to do when it came to that. But just very analytical.
What did you do for fun while when you were growing up?
Oh gosh. Well, when I grew up, it was, there wasn't a concern about where you were or what you did because we were safe. So, we did the usual things. We played baseball. That was a big thing. Hopscotch, jump rope. We rode our bikes all over. And it was one of those things where, you got on your bike and you went over to your friend's house, and that might be, 10 blocks away. But as long as you were home by by dark, you know. I mean, my mother didn't really have any idea where I was in the summer. But she knew I was safe, and I wasn't a bad kid, so she knew I wasn't into anything, that I was probably at somebody's house. So you didn't have to be afraid of anything like that. I mean, when I was little, real little, we used to ride the bus by ourselves at 5, 6, 7. We would walk places. You know, no one ever tried to kidnap us or any of the concerns that you would have today about young children being out and alone, you know, someone snatching them if they're walking to a friend's house. That just wasn't an issue.
Did you play any sports?
Recreationally. And that was mainly baseball.
Right.
And that was always in somebody's yard. I happen to have I live in the house where we moved when I was 13, and we have a big side yard, and we used to it was great for playing baseball because it was long and wide, and so we used to play baseball a lot.
Baseball is really big in like the South, isn't it?
I never thought about it. It was just something you did. It was a lot of fun. And a lot of people could do it at the same time, or you could just have two or three people doing it. I mean, it was never a formal game of baseball. It was just, kind of something we did for fun, and sort of, and we only had one base. It was sort of like cricket in that sense. You'd run to, down the yard, and then, come back. It wasn't like formal baseball, but it was our version, kids' version of baseball. Oh, skating and biking. Biking was big. Everybody had a bike, and everybody had skates.
That sounds fun.
And then when I got to high school, I was really into tennis. And so in the summer, I would get up in the morning. I'd take the bus to the park and to the tennis courts and stay there until like mid-afternoon. And just, whoever came by, we would play tennis together.
You mentioned that Atlanta in this time was really segregated. So, did you have friends of other races, or did you interact with people who weren't black?
Heck no. As it turned out, so I went to an all-black elementary school, and then the when the home that we live in now was built, it was becoming a mecca. Blacks tended to live more in the east side of town, and we started moving west, and different subdivisions were built. And my father subsequently became a had a real estate business. So he was involved in developing this community, and my parents built a house here. And because, I mean, it was very rural. I mean, this was considered the suburbs. Where I live now was considered the suburbs at that time. I'm only about 10, 15 minutes from downtown Atlanta, but it was like light years away back then. So as Blacks moved to this area, there was a high school that was built that was in walking distance of my home. So I went to that high school, and for the 8th and 9th grade. And what happened was so many homes were being built in the area, and so many kids were moving into the area. When I got into the 9th grade, the school actually was on the verge of becoming overcrowded because they grossly underestimated the number of students that would subsequently be attending the school. So they were talking about doing some kind of half day type school, and my first was no way.
Absolutely not.
I want to go to college. What I didn't know at the time there had been a high school, a white high school, that had been desegregated. And so parents got together and said, we want to desegregate another high school. And so they got together, and a group of us who were at Harper High School, which was the name of my high school, Black High School, went over to this white high school and enrolled. And we didn't have, like any issue. And I always say desegregate because integrate to me means that you have interactions. I mean, I knew white students, but they were not my friends. I never went to their houses. They never came to mine. I would never invited them. So there were no issues. You'd had some students who would, kind of say stuff to you, but it was surprisingly easy. We didn't have a lot of the issues that like a Boston had in desegregating schools. But no, kids that I knew at school, no, they weren't. You deal with the stereotypes. I'll give you an example. One day I loved the library. So sometimes after school, I would get on the bus and go to the library. Well, in the area where this school was, there were a lot of middle class families, and most of them had stay at home wives, or
White
mothers,
families.
white families. Yeah. And so, around 2 or 3 o'clock, you would see a lot of domestic workers were getting off, and
They were black.
black, right? And they would get on the bus. Well, one day, this girl I knew, this white girl, she didn't want one of the black women to sit next to her. And I ended up sitting next to her, and I asked her why. I said, but I'm black. And she said, you're not like them. I said, okay. So it was stuff like that. No one ever expressed, I was not called the N-word until I moved to Boston after college. But I never had anything like that. And I sort of only knew it sort of tangentially. I'll tell you another story. When I was very little, my mother was in college. She got married and started having kids while she was in college. And Mars Brown was, well, all the colleges were very family friendly. So a lot of people got married, around 20 and started having kids and still went to school. So my mother would sometimes take us to class with her up to Morris Brown. And I remember in that time we were living on the east side, not too far from downtown. So we probably took the bus or walked, I don't remember. And like the I don't rem know if you remember or ever heard of Woolworth stores.
Oh, yeah, we still have them in Jamaica.
Oh, okay. So a big issue had to do with, they had I guess a cafeteria, with the stools. You sat at the bar and ate. Well, black people, there was a section, it's almost like what today is like a takeout window, or but there next to that where you sat down to eat was this area where black people could come and order food and take it out because you could not sit at the counter and eat. So my mother went there, it must have been maybe around lunchtime or something, and she started to place an order. Well, as I said, this area was right next to the counter, and there was a stool there. And I was a little girl, and I sat down on the stool. So the white guy came and told me, I overheard him tell my mother, I can't serve you now because I had sat on the stool. That was the extent of, but again, very isolated. You didn't, I as a kid don't remember seeing white people. Where we lived was, all black. But there were little things like that. I remember one of the things we used to do, on Sundays was take a ride around town. Y'all get in the car and just drive around town and take a look. And I remember we were in this one area where there was a it was a fairgrounds, and we passed by it. And I said, "Oh, Dad, I'd like to go there." And he said, "Vicky, we can't go there." And I knew exactly what he meant. And I felt bad, not because I couldn't go there. I felt bad because my dad had to say that to me. And I know he felt bad saying, "I cannot take you to this place," because they don't allow Black people in the fair. Every now and then, little things like that. But again, I was so isolated because I grew up in a beautiful Black community.
Did you
And
get?
I'm sorry.
Well, I was gonna ask how you got from this beautiful Black community with that you describe as a center of Black excellence to Smith College.
Because I wanted to get the heck out of Dodge.
Uh-oh.
I knew there were places beyond Atlanta. And you were restricted certain areas. Whenever, we traveled, we were on vacation. It was always a big issue about will there be hotels where we could stay that would allow us? And there was this one chain, and I forget what was the name of it, but it was after. Like after you got past the Carolinas, I think. In the hotel. So that was a kind of thing. So I just wanted to get, I was tired of it. I mean, because of Land of the Water, it was very cliquish. And I felt that a lot of people that I went to school with, one of my best friends just was dying. Her mother had gone to Spelman, and she was just dying to go to Spelman. And I had no interest in any of the schools in Atlanta. I didn't even apply. And also because my older sister was at Spelman, and we're 2 years apart, and in high school, we were, together, but she had originally started at Washington High School, the year before the school that I ended up attending was built. So when we moved here and that high school was built, she transferred over. But because one, she was very smart, and two, because of how outstanding Washington High School was, they skipped her a grade. So she ended up being further ahead of me. But it was always, like her name was Jacqueline. They called her Jackie. I was always Jackie's little sister. You get tired of that. And so I didn't want to repeat that at Spelman. Not that I had any interest whatsoever in going to Spelman. So when I was probably around the 10th grade, I started researching schools. And remember, there was no computer back then, but we had a full set of encyclopedias, and I just started going through reading about different schools. And then around 11th grade, I started sending off information about schools. I mean, it's a very laborious process. If you're going to be looking at schools back then outside of HBCUs. And I really didn't have any interest in going to an HBCU. And I think, it's funny how things all line up in life. I often think that my transferring to this all-white school, which I went 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, set me up for going to school with white kids. So that was a good transition. There was no like culture shock, if you will, about that. Can you still hear me?
Oh, yes, I can't still hear you.
Okay, I just have a call coming in, and I didn't know if it was blocking you. So that's what I did. And I don't know how familiar you are with the situation of the seven black women that graduated in 73. But all of us had started at other schools. I ended up going to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Are you familiar with Smith?
A little bit. You could
Okay.
tell me more about it.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do is I didn't want to go to a city school. So I wanted to be like way out in the country and very isolated type of thing. And thank God I didn't end up going to that type of school, but it was a very small town. And it just so happens that a good friend of my sister's, and I didn't know this, she said, "Oh, Ruth is at Smith. I'll get her to talk to you." I said, "Wow, okay." So I applied to 14 schools, got into 15. It was a school in New Jersey accepted me based on my SAT scores. And so I just sort of, kind of narrowed it down and decided that Smith sounded like it would be a great place to go. And I had a certain level of comfort knowing there's this friend of my sister's who I knew.
You didn't do any visits?
No, we couldn't afford to do any visits. So no, it was just
The fact that
decided
you knew
based
this
on what
one
I knew
person.
about what I had read about, the schools.
That was it, the fact that it was an all-girls school, did that factor into your decision?
Not really, at the time, because I applied to big schools, I applied to small schools, I didn't apply to any schools in the South. I was really interested in going to Stanford. I really wanted to go to Stanford, but I didn't even apply because I thought it was just too far away. And I thought, I don't know how I could afford to, come back and forth, fly back and forth. So I didn't even apply. So I sort of regretted that. And as it turns out, a guy that I knew, who at the same time that who was at Harper with me, but at the same time had the same his parents had the same concerns about was what was going to happen. And this is when the prep schools like Andover and Exeter started accepting black students or really were looking for black students. He ended up going to one of those, and from there, and so I sort of lost touch with him. And then it wasn't until much, many, many years later, I found out that he went to Stanford. But if I had known that, it might have changed my mind. But he was an only child, too, so he didn't have the same financial concerns that I had. And that was the other thing. I always knew that I was going to need to get a scholarship if I wanted to go to the place that I wanted to go to. And so that was also an incentive to be a good student. That I knew, knew. And then I had, two younger siblings. That was the other thing. But I initially loved Smith. It was a great fit for me. It was the right size and location-wise for me. Very, very pretty campus, very pretty campus. And so it was good. And then one of the things I had mentioned to you about having other members of the class of seven, I'll call us, was because we all came from different schools. So three of us, Leslie, Terry, and I, were at Smith. And it was Terry who first told me about the program. By my second year, I was thinking about transferring because I thought I wanted, at that point, I did want more a co-ed situation. And while I felt that there were like absolutely brilliant women at Smith, they didn't really, I don't know how to explain this, but you had all these really bright women, but who didn't necessarily, I don't know, were reticent. I don't know if it's because the age that we grow up in, but didn't often, weren't, you couldn't get into lively discussion. Now, I consider myself an introvert, but I would go to class, and classes were small. So, you know, you might have 10, 15 women in a class. And sometimes there was just not a discussion getting started. So I would start a discussion, you know, because it's like, there are crickets here. And I want to have a discussion, speak up. So that sort of gave me some pause concern because, you know, that's what we were there for. We were to learn, there to learn, to engage, to discuss things, to debate things. And I just wasn't getting that enough.
Their
So,
economics
and it was
classes.
frustrating because these women were brilliant. I mean,
Right.
these weren't like, you know, slugs or anything. These were really smart women. So it was kind of frustrating that we had grown up in a society, I guess, or an environment where that type of discussion, you know, was not something that they were used to, which was very different at Dartmouth because at Dartmouth, I thought, oh, I really got to be on my game when I go to Dartmouth. And it was through the ex an exchange program. Dartmouth had not yet gone co-ed, and other places like Princeton and Harvard always had Radcliffe, but Princeton, Yale, and Brown sort of had all gone co-ed before Dartmouth did.
Yeah, we were the last Ivy to go co-ed.
Yes. And I wish I had known that, but again, I didn't, you know, being in the South, that was not something that the Ivies was just not something that people, you know, you just didn't know. And I had nobody to really counsel me. The college counselor, I digress here, but I'll go back. The college counselor at the white school. So I went in to talk to her. And now I've taken sciences, English. I was in the orchestra, you know, 5 years of math, da, da, da. Plus I had gone to summer school, so I had more classes that I needed to graduate. And if you take out the students that did like gym and back then, you know, home economics and typing and that type of thing, I was probably like one of the, it's hard to say, maybe in the top 25 academically. Because of the classes I took and the grades that I got. But if you add in all the people that, you know, took home economics and, you know, just had a very different course load than I did, you know, so I was further down the list. Oh, now I forgot what I was
The college counselor.
going with. See, I go off on these tangents.
No, that's okay.
Oh, I was talking about the college counselor. So it was a white college counselor. And he started talking to me about going to some technical school in Savannah, Georgia. I was like, do you know what kind of student I am? Do you know the classes I've taken? And you're talking about some technical school in Savannah? And I thought, okay, I'm done with her. So I didn't really have a resource. So a lot of stuff was just done on my own. Now, a neighbor of mine also had become a counselor at the school, but she's not the college counselor. So one time a black woman from Radcliffe came and she said, are there any students I can talk to? And she said, yeah. And so I came down and talked to her, and I became very interested in Radcliffe, and I wish now that I had applied, but it was like around in December, she was like here, I guess, for the holidays. And I had already applied to 14 schools. It was a laborious process. There was no computer, no Common App. You had to do all this stuff by hand. And at first I said, oh, I really want to apply to Radcliffe because I thought she was just like, great. But at the end of the day, I thought, God, I am so tired of filling out applications and getting recommendations and, doing all the paperwork. You have to handwrite your essays. It was, and I just thought, I can't do it. I've had enough. 14 was just way too many. But I was like playing my cards because I was like, I might like here, I might like. So I narrowed it down to 14 colleges. And so I just applied to them. And it took a while because nobody's essay was necessarily the same. It's not like, the Common App. So it was like 14 different essays. I don't know how many I had to write. So it was a lot. So I just didn't apply. And also because I looked at Radcliffe and they weren't. They didn't. Radcliffe was not at that time, at that point, an individual school. So you took all your classes at Harvard. And I was like, oh, this isn't a really a school. It's just the name, not understanding what Harvard was and why actually. And you got your degree and it actually said Harvard back then. It didn't say Radcliffe. And I just thought, oh, this isn't a real school.
You got to Smith in 1968, is that correct?
69.
69, okay. And then you transferred to Dartmouth in.
No, so they had an exchange program that had run for years among all the Ivies where well, it was actually also the schools in the valley, like Amherst and UMass, and there were some you could also go to an HBCU. One of my best friends went to Howard for a year. And because of the social situation with, all male schools, women, they guys would come down to the, go to the Seven Sisters, if you will. And there was a group of guys that my freshman year, before a lot of the Black Dartmouth men went to Holyoke, which was close to Smith. But this group of guys would come down to Smith, and the Black Students Association would have parties and stuff. So starting in my freshman year, I met a lot of guys from Dartmouth, and we became really good friends. I became good friends with a lot of them, and then I would go up to Dartmouth on the weekends, a lot of times because also at that time, I don't know if you knew this, Dartmouth had classes till like noon on Saturdays.
Oh, I did not know that.
And so sometimes it made it hard if a guy was taking a class, had a Saturday morning class, they couldn't come down on Friday nights. Usually that's, they would come down Friday nights, leave after classes and drive down to Smith and party. And then the Black Association at Dartmouth, would have women
And
come out from all different kinds of different schools, and guys would give up their rooms and stuff for us to stay and stuff, and so I knew a lot of guys. That was the place that I knew the most guys. I had other friends where I would go down to Columbia, and I thought that's too far to go regularly. I had a couple of friends at Princeton. I thought that's too far. I went to Yale. Thought that was the ugliest school and gloomiest school I'd ever seen. Because I went down in the winter, and it was, ugh, I did not like Yale at all in the winter. So Dartmouth became my default. I knew the most people there, and so I felt very comfortable. So my sophomore year, as I was mentioning earlier, I started thinking about transferring because I wanted a different experience, and I thought about Stanford. And then I found out at that time, if you transferred, you could not get financial aid your first year. So that kind of blew that up. And so I was thinking, what was I going to do? And I'll never forget, Terry and I lived in the, Terry and Leslie and I, we all three sophomore year lived in the same dorm. And I remember Terry was sitting on the steps for some reason. And I came, and I guess we started talking about what we were going to do junior year, because a lot of people did the abroad thing. And my thing is, I had already decided that I love the econ department at Dartmouth. And I had already decided that I wanted to get a PhD in economics. And so I was very academically focused. So I didn't want to go abroad because I kept thinking, I need these classes. I need these classes. So I was, you know, and so I had taken a bunch of econ courses my freshman and sophomore year. And
Smith.
so I thought, I need to go someplace where I can take econ courses. And the ones that aren't offered at Smith and that are going to help me get in grad school. So I knew nothing about the exchange program. And so Terry started telling me about that she and Leslie were applying to the exchange program at Dartmouth. And I thought, oh, I love Dartmouth. You know, I got a lot of friends there. I know the campus very well. I feel very comfortable there. That would be a great place to go for a year. You know, and probably having that on my academic record would probably help me get into grad school. So I d decided to apply. And, you know, you go through the, you know, it's sort of like a formal application process, and someone would come down from Dartmouth and interview all the people that wanted to go do the exchange program. And actually, my I don't remember. Yeah, I think each year, freshman year and sophomore year, they already had exchange students from different schools, Black women. So I knew them, and I knew they had a good experience. So I thought, oh, I'll apply to that program, and you know, once I go away for a year, you know, and get that experience, I can come back and finish up my senior year. So lo and behold, you know, I got accepted into the program, and so I decided to go because Leslie and Terry had also gotten accepted. So and they were good friends, so that's how I came to Dartmouth. And then at some point in, I think it was, it seems like it was late fall, like towards the end of the term, Dartmouth announced that it was going co-ed, and they
Was
were going to,
1972?
no, let's see. Oh yeah, wait a minute, 69, 70, 70, 71, fall of 71. Yeah. And that they would allow the women that they're were there on the exchange program to apply, because they just had a 2 year residency requirement. So we fit that because we would be there, you know, for a year, and then our senior year would be our second year. So all seven of us applied, never thinking that all seven of us would get in. We had no idea. Because every, I think probably 90% of the women that were there probably applied. So we didn't know what the numbers were going to end up looking like, and we didn't think.
It was, I think, I remember reading an article in the Alumni Magazine, and they said it was 100 out of 150 women applied.
That's what I had the sense of. No one ever gave us numbers, but I had a sense of, you know, I thought most women were having a positive experience and probably would apply. The only hang up was going to be the fact that when you participated, at least from Smith, in the exchange program, you had to sign a document that said you would not apply to transfer. So they had to go for any of the schools, I suppose, that had that, where you had signed that agreement. So they went to Smith and asked if they would allow the Smith women to apply to transfer, and they gave the okay. So then we were officially allowed to, because legally we had a binding agreement that we would not transfer. So probably because they figured, oh, these women get a taste of coeducation and they're gone. So once that we got that waiver, we were good to go. And I mean, we used to have these discussions about, who would probably get in, and and who wouldn't. Not who wouldn't, but any of us could be accepted, but kind of sort of what would be the rationale for who got accepted. And then lo and behold, all of us got accepted, and all of us accepted. It was a very positive experience. I love Dartmouth. I think our experience was very, very unique. And particularly for the women that came from the sister schools and had been coming up to Dartmouth beforehand, we just had a comfort level. And there wasn't any, culture shock or anything like that, because we were doing everything except, going to classes. But we already had a friend set. So it was a very easy transition. And the only thing I was concerned about was the academic rigor, because I thought, these guys, they're gonna be, and I would go to class, so I made sure that I was always super prepared. And I would go to class, and most of the time, especially in econ, I was the only woman and I was the only black person in the majority of my classes that I had there. I thought, I would listen to these guys, and it was obvious to me, because I was so prepared, that they were full of BS. And I said, the professor, probably knows they're full of BS. I was like, have you read the material?
They have
What are you
not
talking about? So I was immediately thought, oh God, I know I compete with these guys. And that was interesting to me from my Smith experience, when women were super prepared and had the intellect, but just were reticent to discuss the topic. Guys would just jump in, didn't know what the heck they were talking about. And I thought, oh my God, I've never seen so or heard so much BS. So that was interesting. So then I immediately said, I got this, I'm not gonna have any problems here.
Did you take any classes outside of econ?
Because I still had requirements to take that were different from Smith's. And it's interesting, because I always thought, sometimes these schools know what they're talking about when they have these requirements, because I had not completed my science requirement. So there was a class called physiology for non-science majors. That turned out to be one of the most fascinating courses I ever took. And if I had taken that earlier, because I became fascinated with the kidneys and their functioning, and if I had taken that earlier, I might have thought about becoming a research scientist, and studying, specializing in the kidneys. But I it was my junior year, and I wasn't about to, change my major at that point. But I thought that was a great class to take. It's very eye-opening. I was more a physics, chemistry type person. I didn't like, I took my first biology class in high school. I did not like dissecting anything. I thought, okay, the biology track is not for me. So my next 2 years, I took chemistry and physics.
Do you ever interact with the AAAS department? Because I know that it was established around that time.
The only thing that I knew, a lot of black guys came there wanting to be go to law school or med school. And a lot of my friends were pre-med, and I knew how, that was a killer track. So I might have been discouraged, but I just thought, oh, I just love this class. And I love learning about, in particular, the kidneys. And I guess just because I'm a very curious person, and that was something, learning how something worked. And so learning how something worked in the body, and I thought the whole process of the kidney, and what it did, was just fascinating. But I might have taken a few more science courses and said, nah, this isn't for me. But because I don't know how I would have felt ultimately if I had had to actually dissect a kidney or something. But that's the only time I thought, huh, I might consider another major. I mean, I actually went to school thinking, went to college thinking I was going to go to law school. And then I ran up against the econ department. And it was just so interesting because you had these very old white men who were economists, and very conservative and straight-laced. And then they had this whole younger group of guys, because even at Smith, a lot of my teachers were male, professors were male, who were like socialists and Marxists and just really interesting characters. And so I thought, man, this is real, this department is really interesting, very diverse in terms of the professors and their outlooks and stuff. And so I became fascinated with that. And that was really why, I switched from thinking I wanted to be a lawyer, to being an economist. But that was the only time. So I still had courses that I had to take. Let's see, I took philosophy, I took history. I don't know. I don't remember if I took any sociology. I think I took, I don't know if it was geology, geography. I needed had to meet a requirement for something. I took, that was one that satisfied that. So no, I think each term I probably took an econ course, but I had more than I had to complete my math requirement there. So I did that. Luckily, I had completed my gym requirement. Does Dartmouth still have a gym requirement? Is that a requirement?
I think there was a swim test when I entered.
Right.
But COVID did a number on that one. So right now it's a bit, I don't, I it's not, I don't have to do it as someone that's graduating in the spring, which is pretty good for me.
Yeah. So I completed that at Smith, which is again, I'll tell you this funny story. So you have to go in and you have to get out of the swim requirement. You have to go and do a swim test. Well, I went to the gym and they told me, and I had taken swimming lessons as a kid, but I was not a strong swimmer and I was not about to jump into the deep end. So they tell you to come in, which I thought was the stupidest thing. You come in and jump in the deep end. And I said, no, I'm not going to jump into the deep end. So that created a big hoopla because they said, well, no one's ever told us that before. And I was thinking, what stupid women who are non-swimmers come up here and jump in the deep end because you tell them to. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't have any problem taking swimming, but as a test, I'm not going to jump in the deep end, drown. So I was like, I can't believe that women would come up here and just be like sheep, and you can't swim or you're not a good swimmer and you're going to jump into the deep end. If they had told me to come in through the shallow, I would have done it, but I was not about to jump into the deep end. I'll say you probably thought, oh, this is what we get for allowing black women.
What was it like being black at Smith versus being black at Dartmouth?
Well, the obvious difference, men versus women. The thing that I did, I wasn't ever into sororities. My mother was a soror. She was a member of a sorority. I don't like cliques, and I don't like, I think my opinion was that when you join sororities, and we had social clubs in high school, we were very bougie. In the Black community, Little Past Black community was very bougie. And like my mother's sororities was big. They did the debutante balls and all of this. And my mother's like, "Oh, you're going to be a debutante?" I was like, "No way. I'm not." And my older sister was the same. It was like, "No, you go off and you go sorority, you have a good time with those, that de whole debutante process, but no thanks, but no thanks." So I wasn't, I just didn't like those. And there were so many cliques when I was in high school and stuff. And I just didn't like it. I just thought you separate yourself from people that you might be very good friends with because of, certain things. And this wasn't coming from a place of, not being popular, because I was, and I was in those clubs, but I just always had an aversion to that. Oh, I should have mentioned that. That was one of the things that was a criteria for me. I didn't want to go to any school that had sororities in France. And although I applied to big universities that had them, I just was not a big believer. So the fact that Smith at that time didn't have any sororities was very, very appealing. But you had your mean girls, even among the Black women. But it's fine. I mean, my closest friend in the world went to graduated from Smith. And Terry and Leslie and I, although we had a similar experience transferring to Dartmouth, I mean, I met them at Smith. It was just a different experience. I mean, it's always different when you have guys around. I mean, it was nice to have a male perspective of things. And I had a lot of friends, and guys were very, very nice to me, overly nice. I mean, from the standpoint of, always wanting to walk me across campus at night. I was like, I don't have any problems. You don't have to walk me across campus. I can defend myself. So, just very, very nice, and just, having platonic friendships, with people. They're guys that I'm still very close to. And far more guys I'm close to than women I'm close to from Smith. There were just some really, really nice Black men at Dartmouth. And we didn't have that experience that a lot of women coming later had. Just the issues and surrounding, women coming up from other schools, and just sort of, I don't know how to explain it, but it was a very unique experience. And I don't think that after us, and maybe the women that were, well, I think that was one or two 74s. I think one, I think there were two 75s. I think there were three women that came after us. And then you had the big class of 76, where that was the first 4-year class.
And they arrived when you were leaving, right? Like you were freshmen. They were freshmen when you were a senior.
And so it was interesting. So senior year, one of the things that we were talking about what we could do, and we're sitting in the Ann with a group of Black women, and we started talking. And I don't know if you've seen, I hope the poster from the one and only Black Women's Conference that was held at Dartmouth. That was the brainchild of myself and Wanda Johnson. And I have a picture. I came across one of the posters, and I had it framed and gifted it to the am. It used to be on the wall there. I don't know if it still is.
Oh, look.
Yeah, but I was surprised that no one else ever did anything around Black women. So that we had speakers come up. We had an exhibit in the rotunda of a couple of Black women artists, prominent Black women artists at the time. A lot of speakers. Tony K. Bambara came up.
When was this?
I think it was in the, I think it was in the spring. So 73, I don't think it was in the fall because it took a lot of planning, a lot of planning. And in the end, it came down to just Wanda and I orchestrating this whole thing. So I don't think it, I don't think the fall term would have given us enough time to do it. And I remember it wasn't cold, so I'm thinking it must have been in the fall of, I mean the winter term, but maybe like spring time.
Yeah.
The date is on the poster, but we were really proud of ourselves. And I know after it was done, it was a, you know, it was a really big success. Wanda and I took ourselves to the Hanover Inn to have dinner and drinks.
Nice.
We were so happy. He said, "Let's go to the Hanover Inn and have dinner and drinks and celebrate."
Was it supported by the entire community, men and women?
Yeah, that we had a couple of guys that were very supportive. Not as many guys as I would have liked. I mean, I would have liked like 90% participation, but it wasn't that high. But all the sessions were packed. And then remember we had all the women from 76. So the turnout was really good. It was really good.
Do you have any thoughts around Black unity on campus at this time?
Oh, tremendous. We were a great community, very supportive, very involved, very active. You know, I lived in the Chokes, you know, and I loved that because, you know, I come out of my dorm, go in through the basement, you know, of the am, up the steps, see what's in there, you know, and then out. And I come back and go through the am, see who was there, you know, stop and talk, you know, down the basement, out the door, over to my dorm. So I, you know, I was like in and out of there, you know, several times a day. But I thought it was a great community. I mean, there are people that I just love to death from Dartmouth who are just great people. Great people. So, you know, it was fortuitous because I don't know if I would have liked it hearing some of the issues that some of the women have. And, you know, I was very involved with Dartmouth for over 2 decades at least. I've been an interviewer and I was on the alumni council. So I've done a lot of work for Dartmouth. I used to like to do the, I become discouraged now, but you know, and when I would go back for reunions and different events and particularly reunions and talk to other Black women and who just had a horrible experience and I just cannot fathom. I think going to college, I mean, I personally think it should just be a magical experience for you. And I just I always feel bad for those, for people who just hated their college experience and had, a lot of issues. Because, I had a really great experience. And I think the men there at the time were very special people.
That's fair. I mean, I'm one of those persons that does not like their college experience. But
No.
I understand that it's quite it's there's like a very diverse set of opinions. So that's fair.
Yeah, I think I just lucked out. It was a very special time in this country. A very special time in terms of what white colleges were trying to do around diversity. And gender equality. And so, I would do it again. I would do it again.
Was Lorna C. Hill one of the students that you remember, one of the women?
Yeah, but we weren't, we were more acquaintances. We weren't friends. I think she went to Wellesley, and we just had a very different track and set of friends, so never really socialized with her or really had any contact or experiences with her. So she was probably the only one that I didn't get to know. All the
Seven
I'm sorry.
of the seven, right? She was one of the
Yeah.
seven.
Yeah.
I believe she was really involved in the theater scene, so I'm
Right.
sure it was just like, just your path never crossed.
Not really. She didn't live anywhere near me. And again, she was very involved in the theater. And yeah, just I just knew her in passing. So I can't say we were friends or anything like that. We were acquaintances, But yeah, the rest of us, particularly senior year, all of us lived in the Chokes except Lorna.
Okay.
Now, Leslie, wait a minute. Terry, Wanda, Brenda, Lucinda. I can't, maybe Leslie didn't. At least five of us lived in the Chokes.
Do you remember there being alphas on campus while you were there?
Being what?
Alphas, Alpha Phi Alpha, the fraternity, the black
No,
fraternity.
I think those fraternities came after I left.
Okay.
I don't remember any fraternities among the with the guys I knew. Yeah, so I think that was after. And it may have been soon after. I think they did come in the 70s, but I'm not sure. But and if there were, it was a very small outpost, but I don't ever remember that there were any frats even started when I was there.
Were there any extracurricular activities that you were involved in while at Dartmouth?
No, and that's one of the regrets I have. I mean, I think the one thing I didn't do was take advantage of everything there was to offer there. For instance, Wanda and I decided that we wanted to learn how to ski, and we were going to ski winter term. We're going to take a skiing class. Which it was extracurricular, but you got free skiing lessons and all the equipment and stuff. So we signed up for that. Lo and behold, when we came back, winter term, we were like, oh no, it's way too cold. And oh no, what if we break something? And you know how the winters are there. And I don't know if they are as bad, but you literally walk through walls of snow, when it would come and get the snow off the sidewalks and the street, and there would become like piles and piles of dirty, nasty looking snow and very slippery and stuff. And we were like, can you imagine if you broke your leg, your arm trying to maneuver? So we said, nah, not gonna do it. And then lo and behold, when I years later, when I moved to got a job in Boston and moved to Boston, and had a friend, had a group of friends that were skiers, and then I got into skiing. I was like, I had to pay all this money to take skiing lessons, yada yada yada, and I could have done all of this for free. I was like, geez, who would have thought that, 10 years later, I'm going to become an avid skier and have to spend all this money to learn how to ski when I could have learned how to ski at Dartmouth for free. So I was like, gosh. And that was one thing I regretted. I thought, why didn't I just punked out on that? We just started talking to each other about how cold it was going to be and breaking something, and we really talked ourselves out of it.
Did you ever work on campus? Like, did you have
Oh
a
yeah, I had a work study job. I worked at the museum.
Oh, nice.
That was the
The
only place I worked. I worked at the museum in the administrative part of it.
Was that common for students to have work studies?
Yeah, because Wanda and I did it. We both worked in the museum. But yeah, a lot of people, and that was a great job because I certainly did not want to work at Thayer Hall. But yeah.
Design and services.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did, and it was more for us. Thankfully we had good financial aid, but it was like our spending money. So it was good from that standpoint.
Do you remember the murals being painted in Chippewas? I think that might have
Oh,
taken place during this time.
yes. That was done while I was there. Yeah. That
Did
was
you
a great source of pride.
pose? Like, I know that he took he asked certain students, the artist Florian Jenkins, asked certain students to pose for some of the panels.
No.
I live in Shabazz right now, which is Qatar, as you used to call it. So I see them every day.
Yeah, I it was great. And once I was up there, and I don't know if they still have the brochures,
Yeah.
but the brochure that the museum did was an idea that I suggested to them, because there was nothing had ever been done, written up and formalized. They talked about the murals. So they produced that brochure. And hopefully it's still around somewhere.
Yeah, we have. I'm not sure if it's the same one, but we do have like brochures in the mural room for any visitors. I also wanted to mention that there's a group called Black Girls Are Magic on campus, and they don't have a conference, but they'll have socials and they have hair care events for Black women. So that's, like there is still that tradition here of
Oh, good.
Black women looking out for each other.
Good.
So for the final part of the interview, I just wanted to transition into your life after Dartmouth. So if you could just tell me a little bit about what you did immediately after graduating.
Well, I applied to doctoral programs in economics, and I ended up going to the University of Michigan, because I don't know if you're aware, University of Michigan has been sort of at the forefront in terms of diversity. So I got a full ride there, and it was quite a shock. I mean, it was a big culture shock to, because the U University of Michigan is a huge school, and the economics is a very, very small department. And I started the summer after graduation, which was a mistake. I should have taken the summer off. So I went up there, and then I was immediately disappointed. I didn't like the school. I didn't like the size of the school. It was overwhelming. I didn't know anybody up there. It's things like you feel it because one, just the campus and the thousands upon students that are there. And then even though we had, it was a very small department, you had to register with everybody else. So you're standing in this huge space with thousands and thousands of people trying to register for classes, and it was just overwhelming. Didn't particularly like the department, very staid. And the other shock was, okay, actually, you should think that it's going to be more like 5 years to get your doctorate, because the right, doing your thesis and getting approved and going through that whole process is very laborious and it takes a long time. So it's not unusual for it to take 5 years. And I was like, what? And then my idea was that I wanted to be an economist for a bank. And when I really looked into it, I found out that you didn't get that. Usually it was white guys who had been, when you would work for about 2 decades as a professor and gained a reputation, then you might get hired as a economist for a bank. But those positions were few and far between, unlike, in subsequent years where, there were more jobs like that in banking. So I thought, and so most of the jobs that were available were to teach, like assistant professors, yada yada. I was like, God, I don't want to be a college professor. So that was surprising. Goal of being an economist for a bank.
I'm so sorry, Vicky. Could
Because I
you,
never.
Vicky?
Yes.
Could you repeat what you said after I don't want to be a college professor?
Well, that was pretty much it. I just knew going in that I didn't want to teach, and I had never really thought about that. I thought that, and I don't remember where I got that idea from, but that was my idea. That was my goal. And the fact that it was going to be a long-term goal instead of a short-term goal, I didn't want to do. I didn't. So, what I decided to do was, I thought, geez, I really need to hone in on what it is that I can do, because the career path that's going to be mapped out for me is not one that I want. My goal, my dream job, if you will, is it's going to be, many, many, many years out. And I didn't think I had the patience to teach. So I thought, okay, I need to leave, go and work, and decide what I want to do. And so I went to the school and said, talked to the dean, and I said, I want to take a leave for a year, find out, what it is I really want to do and how can I approach this and yada yada yada, and then return. And I said, fine. I had my boyfriend at the time was a Dartmouth grad, was a Dartmouth. I had met at Dartmouth, and he was in Chicago in med school. So I said, that's a quick transition. That's close. So I'll move to Chicago and get a job and, kind of fill this out. So I did that. And then I decided, well, what was really going to get me where I wanted to go was to get an MBA. So I went back to the University of Chicago and got my MBA with a concentration in marketing. And my career has been in that, was in that, that field. So I worked for a number of Fortune 500 companies, a large consulting company, Booz Allen and Hamilton. After I worked for them, I wanted to be on the corporate side rather than on the consulting side. So I moved into a corporate environment and had a really good career after that.
Would you say that Dartmouth prepared you to work in corporate, and like in what ways?
Well, I think my whole life prepared me. I think that it was kind of destiny that the powers that be prepared me. And I think that was the whole journey, the transition from, an all white school, and dealing with that environment, then going on to Dartmouth, where I was in an environment just like I was going to have in corporate America, surrounded by white men, because I was at the forefront of women that were going after careers, and not the married mommy track. And that's when companies were starting to open up to women and open up to Black women. So for most of my career, I've been the first woman, the first Black woman, the first Black person in any job I've ever had. I just said, well, I hope my performance makes it easier for the people of color coming after me, and particularly women of color, because I was always out there on the ledge by myself.
Did you feel isolated working?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. This stuff doesn't get to me. Again, I think my upbringing and what I experienced growing up, the level of confidence that I had, I always knew I am a very smart person. I'm a brilliant strategist. I'm a brilliant marketer. And I had the experience to back it up. So anything anybody thought about me that was less than that, I didn't, consider. But I knew that I was breaking barriers for a lot of the white people I worked with. It was the first time they ever worked with and knew a Black person. It was what it was, but no, it didn't stress me out. Or, I see the opportunities that women have now, which were not open to me. And I sort of said, gosh, I wish I had been able to do this, that, and the other. But I remember my mother saying that as well. I don't think that my mother would have taught school. She wanted to go to law school. But that was just not a career track for many Black women. One of her best friends actually was the person that brought a lawsuit against the University of Georgia because they would not accept him into the law school because he was Black. And he ended up going to Northwestern law school. But, a Black man, had a lot of problems. It was just not a track open to my mom at the time. So, I mean, and that's going to be the way it is for a long time, for a lot of generations, you like blacks in technology, that's been a very hard field for large numbers of blacks to get into. I remember I actually got invited to do an interview at Apple back in the day, and if they had hired me, I'd be a very wealthy woman by now. Because that was at the they had just become, leading tech company. So it was in the beginning in the heyday of Apple. They showed me around, they call it a campus. I did not see one black person at Apple. And I knew that they were not going to hire me. But you go through all these things. I had this guy, I don't remember what company it was, but I was back on the East Coast, and this guy flew me out. And I don't remember if it was Chicago or somewhere. And then it was Midwest. And he said, oh, now, I would probably sue them. But he said, I just wanted to meet you because when I saw your resume and you're a black woman that went to an Ivy League school, I just wanted to meet you. Now, nobody w now would they be wise not to say that. They've been well versed by HR to say something like that. I was like, are you kidding me? And then I had another investment company do the same thing. Because I had written them a letter. They had done something that I was very impressed by. And I just sent them a letter, talking about whatever. And then they invited me to come up for an interview. And then they too said, oh, well, we really don't have anything. Now, maybe both were lying and they just, but they had me believe that they were interviewing me for a job. They wanted to interview me for a job. So it's like stuff like that, People want to meet you because you're like a unicorn. You're black, you're a woman, and you went to an Ivy League school. You went to one of the top five business schools in the country. Wow. So yeah, it was like, the monkey in the zoo. Let's go see the monkey in the zoo type of thing. But that's, I just said, it was their loss, not my loss. Although I really wish I had that Apple stock. But no, you're always in the vanguard, and somebody's always, breaking barriers and, and I like to think that the seven of us said, hey, black women can come and thrive at Dartmouth. And so we don't have to be concerned about, can they make us? And I say we were a sure thing because not only did they have our first term grades, by the time they had admitted us, we had probably gone through midterms. So they knew, academically that we could do the work. Unlike, taking in freshmen, you think they can do the work, but, you don't know until they actually, take the classes and get the grades. So they knew that we were academically strong. So it wasn't that much of a risk, right? Like,
They also knew you were socially plugged in as well.
But again, those are all things that, you accept as you know that you are the first anything. And again, because I knew I was, shall we say, inference good enough and strong enough, and prepared enough that I could do it. I've had three VPs that I had worked with who all said the same thing. You are one of the smartest people I've ever worked with. And I knew it. Well, not that they, had ever worked with, but that I was that good. In fact, when I worked at one company, for senior VP, and he reports into the CEO, and the CEO had to review his okay, I'm drawing a blank, but your how you did, right? And so he wrote up my review, and he told me, the guy said, nobody can be this good. Go back and rewrite it, find something. So he said, I just want to tell you the stuff that I had to put in there that were very minor things, but he would just not let me give you like a wonderful 100% glowing review. He said, nobody could be that good.
I'm thinking you must have retired by now.
Oh yeah. I got I was, sometimes breaking barriers is tiresome. And sometimes you just say enough is enough. And I was ready to go.
Did you retire early or?
I would have worked longer had I been happier with the trajectory of where I was going. But certain things just, I mean, I was privy because of my level to be aware of certain things. And where I was, I just didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Do you feel like you were sort of prevented from like going to the highest position because of your identity?
Yeah.
You were put in
It's
a box.
it's hard work. Like, well, I won't say that. It might sound racist. But sometimes men can rise to high levels, even if they're incompetent. I would not have, the saying about being 10 times better just to be, considered average, that you have to be brilliant from the get-go. Where there can be no denying that you're, pretty good. I'll give you an example. I was asked to attend a meeting, and I don't remember the exact, but with a group of board members of the company. And we went through some exercises. I don't remember what it was, but we went through some exercises with them doing something. Then we were each asked to present our idea or concept or something. And I was one of the, in terms of level, junior members, if you will. And I was on this team who had two people that were considerably higher than two women, as it turned out, that were higher than me. So they said, okay, well, who wants to present from this group? Well, these two women just sat there because I was expecting, okay, you're at, this very high senior level, and I'm expecting them to say, I'll present. They sat there and I said, okay. So I finally spoke up and said, because there were only three of us and they weren't volunteering. So that kind of, by default left me. And I was expecting them. And I said, I'll do it. And then I said, and I'd like for whoever to do it with me. So I got up there, and presented. And I was like, I can't believe that, they wouldn't volunteer. I mean, that just astounded me. So anyway, I happened to be sitting ne next to one of the board members, and we started talking, and he said, I hope that I get to meet with you again. You're in one of our meetings or something to that effect. So I had impressed him, a board member of a major Fortune 500 company. I had impressed him enough that he thought I deserved to be in meetings with the board. But that was an outside perspective, right? Whereas inside, it can be a lot of other things that, and I, we used to have what we call people meetings, and that's when, you come together as the department, all the senior members, and talk about the folks that worked in the department and their review and their performance and, what were your impressions of them, yada, yada, yada. So we talk about everybody, not just our direct reports. And I saw how some people that I would not have said were racist would talk about people of color. And, it's just like behind closed doors, things get said. And you can say, oh, that's my opinion, that's my assessment, and you think that is tinged with more than a little racism. If this person had been white, you would not be saying this. This is a really gifted person. And that's one of the reasons, actually, to come full circle, how I started interviewing and writing up the recommendations, or the, I don't know what they call it now, don't forget. But when I worked in
Recommendation.
Gillette, and there was a white guy that worked in Gillette, at Gillette, and somehow they put us in contact, and we said, okay, we'll do the interviews together. And I've always said I really want to interview particularly Black applicants and students of color. So we were interviewing, and we had interviewed this great young Black guy. And so we talked about his review. This guy had like a total different impression of this young man than I did. So I was just astounded. Now, not using, any type of racial language, but just, if this kid w had been white, would you have said that your impressions been the same? So I said, you know what? I'm going to volunteer to, I'll write up all the reviews. I wrote this guy up, and I thought, this is why Black alumni have to get involved in the interviewing process, because some alumni are probably really not giving an unbiased review of these kids. It is shaded by their race, and that made me committed to doing. And I always wanted to do them by myself, and so I could, write up the review myself, because I just wanted an honest assessment. And it wasn't like I thought every, Black student was phenomenal, but I thought I gave them a fair assessment. And there were a lot that were phenomenal, and that's why I stopped, because I became, and I know it's tough to get into Dartmouth, really tough to get into Dartmouth, but I just did not understand, based on the what Dartmouth was looking for, why some of these students didn't get in. So after, 20 plus years of doing it, I thought, I don't want to do this anymore, because I spent a lot of time. Because, as you can tell, I'm a talker, and I spend anywhere, usually at least 90 minutes to 2 hours talking to every student. So I think that I get a pretty good overview of who they are, whether or not, and I don't think Dartmouth is right for everyone. I really don't. I think it takes, Dartmouth is a horse of a different color. And I think, you get a feel for what students would thrive in that environment and what students would probably struggle. So it just became heartbreaking to a certain extent that, when certain people didn't get in. And I couldn't understand why. So I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. It's too tough emotionally because you get invested in these kids. And I've had a lot of, because I spent a lot of time and I always did with these young applicants, I think I get, I'm not doing a 15, 20, 30 minute interview. I'm really spending time with these students and talking to them. And I mean, I've had some really interesting, good conversations with students, particularly biracial students. They share a lot about, their dealings with that and their experiences with that. Because I think I'm easy to talk to and I'm genuinely interested. So they usually open up and share a lot with me. So I think I can give them a really good assessment. Whereas, when you spend 15 minutes and you ask the usual questions, you're not getting a lot of insight into who that student is. So yeah, it became very frustrating. But for a long time, I did a lot, a lot for Dartmouth. And mainly because, one thing, I thought I had a very good experience there. And I would recommend Dartmouth. Again, not everybody's right for Dartmouth. But I think there are students who would really thrive there and it would be a good experience. So now I don't do a lot, if anything, anymore.
So, I would like to actually end this interview by asking why you're taking part in this project. And I think it's like quite relevant since you just said you're not really as involved with Dartmouth as you used to be.
Well, because I think I had a unique experience there. I think I'm very involved in my own ancestral search and gaining information. And I think that the experiences of Black people on Dartmouth's campus should be in the archives. I think that 100, 200 years, people will want to know about those experiences and what was it like, and especially being one of the first women to graduate, and being a Black woman who was in that class. I just think it's important for our voices to be heard and our experiences. And that's one of the things that I mentioned to you earlier about because the seven women, outside of the three of us, the other four women, three had come from HBCUs, and four came from sister schools, Ivy League schools. The journey was, very different. And my perspective could be very different from Wanda's versus Brenda's or
Wanda Johnson.
I think she came from Stevens College somewhere in the Midwest. I think she was from Tennessee. Four of us were from the South, and three were from the North. Leslie was New York, Upper New York. Terry was Midwest. I'm not sure where Lorna was from, but somewhere
Just from
north,
New
I think.
Jersey.
Yeah. But our journeys were just so unique and different. And especially for the three that had no relationship or knowledge of Dartmouth before they came, they'd never stepped foot on the campus. Their journey was experience was probably very different. It's not something we ever really talked about. It's not of interest, I suppose, to us at the time. But now, that I thought about it, I thought, oh, wow, probably be very, very different. But I like the idea, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to give the poster to the AM was because, hey, Black women were here. And we were active on campus and involved. And I also sent one to the archives. Just so it didn't get lost in history. If you want your history written the way you want it written, you have to do it yourself. So I am thrilled about the project and to have this history documented in the archives.
We're really thrilled to have your voice reflected in the archives as well, because we think it's a really important addition.
Yeah, and I love Darby. And I had a great experience. So, despite, the time and place, it's important to know that a Black woman came there and, thrived from it. It was a benefit, and I hope I've contributed something, back to the college in turn. I spent many hours on Dartmouth's behalf. So I think I've earned my keep. So I appreciate it. Thanks so much for reaching out.
Thank you for accepting. I know that you weren't like 100%, like feeling 100%. So thank you for like finding the time and strength to do this.
Well, I really, as I said, I really wanted to do it. And I do think that the work that you're doing and your colleagues are doing is very important to get our history in the archives so that we are not forgotten people and in a place where it's easily acceptable. I've dealt along many for many years with archives. And in fact, I have some stuff from one of the former presidents who's now deceased of BATA. He gave me years ago that I didn't some of it I sent to the archives and unfortunately I came across some additional stuff that I had tucked away that I need to send to the archives. So I'm definitely on board with regard to and supportive of documenting the history of Blacks on campus and the work that's been done about was it Woody Lee who did the thing? Yeah, that was just outstanding, the work that he's done. And at one point I had tried to do some research on the slaves that were brought to Dartmouth, but I ran into a dead end because I was very interested in trying to find out some information. I found some a little information, but the when I was doing it, and there may be more resources available, someone to have more success with doing it. But I've been documenting my family ancestry. Oh gosh, for over 20 years now. And I've learned a lot, learned a whole lot that I'm glad to know because my journey, my family's journey in America goes back much further than I knew, and found out that some of my ancestors were likely brought over in the among the first wave of Africans brought over, and it goes back to the 1600s. It's nice to know. It's like go back to where you came from. What are you? Your family's been here 25 years, 50 years. Well, how about 300 years, 400 years? So it's been eye-opening for me to have that information and to be able to see how my southern male ancestors here in the South registered to vote doing Reconstruction, and how dangerous that was for them, and how brave it was for them. Many of them could not write, so you have their X, and then somebody wrote in their name. But even though they might not been able to read or write, they wanted to take advantage of the right to vote. And knowing what happened after Reconstruction, after the North moved its troops out of the South, they lost that. But when people forget about that period of time when Blacks were allowed, well, you had to meet certain criteria, obviously, but if you met that criteria for a brief time during Reconstruction, they were able to vote. So the right to vote was here and then disappeared for a very, very long time. But that's incredibly moving to know.
I
So.
will. I'll do a bit of digging around and see if I can point you in the resource, in the direction of any resources on slavery at Dartmouth, because there has been, like, some recent,
Yeah,
advancements
there
in
was something
history.
written
So,
many years ago that it had the names of the slaves. I worked through ancestry.com, and so I went in and tried to research on them to see. But I could find, very little. I mean, there was some interesting information there, but they sort of disappeared. And that's what happened with a lot of Black folks, even my relatives. They're there and then they're not on the census for a while and then they come back, I haven't done anything on that for probably maybe was that 10 years ago? So there may be more information that was available, but I don't think I was really aware of that. When I certainly not when I was there, none of us were thinking about that. And I don't think that was ever documented anywhere initially. But I did find, oh gosh, who was it? Was it Carver that came to campus and he wrote a letter to the professor and his wife, thanking them for their hospitality? And he was sending him, I think it was Carver, because he said he was sending them some sweet potatoes.
Right.
And that was really interesting. But I will let you go. Thank you so much for letting me go on and on and on.
Oh, no, thanks for the additional information. I'm gonna stop the recording now.
Okay.